rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, all sorts of stuff coming out here. Don Rumsfeld, it turns out, was on the board of directors of the company that sold the nuclear reactors to North Korea that they used to extract plutonium. He's now saying, gee, I didn't know about that. Other members of the board are saying, yeah, we discussed that. In fact, you were lobbying for it. Interesting. Is there a naval buildup going on in the Persian Gulf? Is it preparation for an October surprise? Or is this something being peddled by Lynn and LaRouche? We'll be discussing that. Our quote for the day from Edward R. Murrow: we must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. This in 1954. We must remember always that accusation is not proof and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear of one or another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason. If we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were, for the moment, unpopular. Also coming up on today's program, Amy Goodman's going to be here in the second hour of our program. Her new book, Static: Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. That and more, and your calls as well. Right now, Dennis Avery is with us. He's the director of global food issues at the Conservative Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to the Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website. Dennis, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here with us. You are out doing a media blitz here, making yourself available to talk show hosts all around the country, suggesting that biofuels is a bad idea because if we were to try to replace oil and gasoline with fuels grown that we grow, we'd have to cut down all our forests and stop eating. Am I getting that?
That's just
in a
about
nutshell?
It. Biofuels take too much land that we don't have.
So why not combine biofuels, wind, solar, and conservation? Why not instead of promoting, instead of just throwing our hands up in the air and saying, you know, it's just there's just not enough land to grow all this biofuel. We just need to stick with oil. Instead of that, why not promote a comprehensive solution? Why not be part of the solution instead of continuing the problem, Dennis?
Well, the only big, efficient source of energy that we're not using is nuclear. That's the way out, at least for the next couple of centuries.
So now,
remember also that we've got a couple of centuries worth of fossil fuels,
particularly coal. So instead of, but you know, oil looks like maybe what 30, 40 years left. But
we've got 2.5 trillion barrels of oil in the Athabasca tar sands, just 400 miles north of Montana.
Yeah, in the tar sands.
The
okay.
Athabasca tar sands.
Yeah, that is not oil when it's extracted. That's tar sands. But your point is well taken. Competitive Enterprise Institute, it sounds like you're now promoting nuclear. Have you lost your funding from ExxonMobil and now you're getting it from the nuclear industry?
I don't get any funding from any of those people.
Okay, well,
I get my salary from Hudson.
Forgive my cynicism, but you're saying that nuclear power is the way to go. Nuclear power requires enormous amounts of oil to find, to mine, to refine,
modest
to transport
the
uranium itself.
We've got a 1,500-year climate cycle. We found it in the ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic 20-some years ago. We've now found that 1,500-year cycle in seabed sediments in six oceans, in cave stalagmites all over the world, every continent.
Yeah, nobody's disputing that, but that's not the current crisis.
So why are we going to biofuels that would cause us to cut huge amounts of our forest?
Well, it wouldn't have to cause us to cut huge amounts of our forest. First of all, you're talking in the paper that I have of yours. You're talking about ethanol, the crops that we're growing, principally corn, to produce ethanol, are not the most efficient producers of ethanol. But down in Brazil,
can't grow sugarcane.
Exactly, you're right. But down in Brazil, where they can grow sugarcane, which is a very efficient producer of ethanol, they're doing very well. Thank you very much. More than half the cars in the country are running on ethanol,
well,
and they're
running,
moving toward 100% of it. But
they're replacing 20% of their petroleum with sugarcane because they're a tropical country and the only big country in the world with lots of spare land.
But here in the United States, rather than going with ethanol, why don't we go with biodiesel? There are a lot of crops ranging from hemp to rapeseed oil that can produce enormous quantities of oil that can be used for biodiesel.
Biodiesel produces 50 gallons of diesel per acre per year.
With which crop?
Soybeans.
Well, see, I wouldn't say that soybeans are the most efficient producers of oil. In Europe, in Germany, biodiesel is widely used. In fact, every gas station is required to sell it, and they get it from what they call rapeseed oil.
We can grow rapeseed oil, and it's a less efficient source of oil than soybeans, but the Germans can't grow it, so they grow rapeseed. But the price that they're offering their farmers is ridiculously high. And the environmental movement over there is already up in arms because they're going to plant these oil crops on what has been diverted land set aside. And the environmentalists are up in arms about losing this wildlife habitat.
So why shouldn't we then instead, Dennis Avery? I mean, here you are. You're with two think tanks that presumably are looking at the issues of the world and the problems of the world and saying, hey, let's come up with reasonable solutions. Why shouldn't we be looking at ways to reorganize the way we live?
To
our cities and our suburbs so that they're not dependent upon automobile transportation, to enhance our mass transit infrastructure, to increase the efficiency of our appliances and our vehicles, and build out and put money into building out the alternatives to energy. You talk about nuclear. Nuclear energy can't exist without massive subsidies from the U.S. government. No insurance company in the world will insure a nuclear power plant. That should tell you something.
We can do passive safety nuclear plants. One's being built right now in South Africa. Another's being built in Finland. But conservation, as you mentioned, makes sense. Hybrid cars are a good idea. Insulation is a good idea. But what I'm trying to get across to you is that we have panicked ourselves into an corn ethanol subsidy that threatens 50 or 100 million acres of our forest with being cleared for low-yield, low-quality auto fuel.
Don't you think that subsidy that we've been giving for corn for the last 20 years that's causing us to wipe out small subsistence farmers in Central and South America and that's caused the entire candy industry to flip from cane sugar to corn syrup, which some argue is producing an epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes, is the same kind of problem?
Oh, I would get rid of all of the farm subsidies.
Yeah, okay. So back to the issue of energy here in the United States. Why just go out and say no ethanol, no biodiesel, let's go nuclear, and not as aggressively speak about these other issues?
I mean, 250 gallons worth of gasoline per acre per year from corn. It's tiny, and it's a 25% net gain in energy. After you factor in all of the fertilizer and tractor fuel and processing heat.
Well, I'm agreeing with you. Corn is not the most efficient crop to produce
biofuels. Biofuels are a lousy idea unless you're Brazil. Now, if you can get past the corn lobby and take off the 54-cent tariff on importing ethanol from Brazil, then you can tap into that.
Yeah, well,
that would make some sense.
Seems like a reasonable step, and for that matter, taking the tariff off cane sugar and importing cane sugar.
Well,
and make our own ethanol.
No, you got to process that cane sugar while it's fresh.
No, I'm talking about in order to make ethanol. No, when I was in college, we made ethanol in the garage out of cane sugar. No problem at all.
I mean, take your ethanol in Brazil, concentrate the product, and bring it up in tankers.
Yeah, well, that's probably more efficient. Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, why are you? It just seems that you're out there.
Whatever you can buy cost effectively from Brazil, that's fine. What I'm saying is let's not destroy America's forests to grow tiny amounts of a low-grade auto fuel.
Okay. And you know, in and of itself, I don't disagree with that, but it just it seems like you're
50 million
the argument that you're putting out is purely limited to that, and it doesn't talk about the larger issue, the larger context, all the other things that we can and should be doing. Instead, it's simply basically
don't
you're saying,
panic.
You know, yeah, don't panic.
Don't
just leave it all to ExxonMobil.
And don't panic about global warming. And don't clear all our forests for corn ethanol.
Yeah, and let's let Lee Raymond make another $400 million retirement fee, huh?
I can't keep people from making money out of things people want.
There you go. Dennis Avery, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Dennis, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back. In the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. In view of Pyongyang's apparent nuclear test, writes Kaev Alhaza Afrasabi in the Asia Times. Interesting. You've got to go to the Asia Times to get a good story on the Middle East. In view of Pyongyang's apparent nuclear test with a new flare-up in North Korea's nuclear crisis promising serious geostrategic ramifications on a long-term basis, the pertinent question is, how will this affect the Iran nuclear standoff? And of course, back to the point of our last debate, you know, why are we even, you know, going through all this thing with Iran if it weren't for the fact that we're importing all this oil? I mean, Iran is sitting on top of an enormous amount of oil. It turns out that Iran may have more oil than Iraq has. And you know what Cheney said about Iraq?
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And so now it's like, okay, the Eisenhower battle group is on its way to Iran, but is it there simply to you know, give a break to the ships that are there? So that we can be off the coast and available to help out in Afghanistan and in Iraq? Or is this the October surprise? And has this nuclear test by North Korea, which may or may not have been a dud, a lot of discussion about that, is this going to divert attention away from what's going on in Iran? And if so, is that going to help or hurt Bush and the Republicans, if their goal was to ramp up hysteria about Iran? Because I'll tell you, you know, here sitting in the talk show seat, you get all these emails from these various groups saying, you know, this is what we need to talk about right now. And the right-wingers are all starting to circle the wagons around Iran. I'm telling you, watch the talk show hosts in the next 2 weekends, the corporate talk show hosts, where they get the corporate-friendly and basically administration-friendly, GOP-friendly, even the Democrats, on there. Is Iran going to be the big issue? Are they going to start beating the drums for Iran? And if so, is this being done for political gain? Or is this being done because we're trying to nail down the Middle East as tightly and as hard as we can? Because why? We want their oil. I mean, is there anybody who doesn't think that that's the case? If there is, I've got a fine bridge in Brooklyn that I'd be glad to sell you for just $500. Anyhow, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Over at globalresearch.ca, the global research site, some extraordinary and in-depth thoughts on the naval armada in the Persian Gulf. Which Canada is participating in, which is one of the things that has the Canadians concerned about it. And they talk about, we bring this attention to our readers, a carefully documented review of the ongoing buildup. They call it the battle for oil. And Israel and NATO are going to be playing a role in this and directed against Syria, is it going to be? Is this going to be, you know, following up on UN Security Resolution 1701? Was Lebanon a test? I don't know. I don't think any of us know right now what level of Machiavellian intent or depravity might be going on inside the office of Karl Rove. I do know, or I do believe, that the invasion of Iraq was done for political purposes. Mickey Herskowitz, the guy that the Bush family, the old Bush family friend that the Bush family hired to write A Charge to Keep, which is the official autobiography of George W. Bush. No, he didn't write his own autobiography. Just like Rush Limbaugh didn't write his own books. You know, they get ghostwriters. I, by the way, have written all of my own books, just for the record. Nonetheless, Mickey Herskowitz, the guy that the Bush family hired to write A Charge to Keep, Bush's autobiography, he wrote the first draft. Then they got somebody else to write the to clean it up and do the second draft because his first draft wasn't quite glowing enough. He later told a reporter that Bush had been planning. He did his research on this thing in 98, 99, that in 99 Bush was planning on invading Iraq. And this is consistent with what Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, said a year ago, that Bush, the very first meeting that they had in Bush, in Paul O'Neill's book, the very first meeting that they had in January, right after the Supreme Court installed George Bush in the White House, was about how to invade Iraq. Here's Cindy Sheehan about Mickey Herskowitz.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
And keep in mind, back in 77, when Bush ran for the House of Representatives from Texas, unsuccessfully and failed, his main campaign slogan was, "Let's roll back the New Deal. Let's privatize Social Security." But this is all about political agenda and all about getting elected. Now 2,700 Americans are dead. 100,000 Iraqis are dead. 100 people a day are showing up, you know, with torture marks and bullets in the head. And are we going to now bring the wonders of this to Iran as well? We'll be taking your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
I got news of the very best kind about troubles that are falling behind about people. That used to be blind till they open up their eyes to see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor, until the day that they die they're tired of pie in the sky and they want some security. And it's news, ain't that news, ain't that something to see.
And welcome back. Telling the truth to multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. First person to post the correct answer to "What's the Bush Administration's October Surprise?" gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll put up a poll on the message board so our members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, and the winner will be announced on November 13th. You can get it all over at just go to TomHartman.com and click on the message board /blog listing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, live while we're on the air, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, from noon to 3 Eastern time, Monday through Friday, 9 to noon Pacific time, and all other, you know, you can do the math anywhere else in the world. Judy in Dana Point, California. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to your guest, and I don't know if you're aware of it, I just saw a very small article and a little snap on the news. The University of Riverside has developed a process that takes all the garbage and sludge and they put it through this machine and it comes out to really clear biodiesel.
Yeah.
They did patent it and they are going to build two plants here in California.
Yes, and in fact there was an article, a year and a half ago or so in Scientific American, as I recall, where they rolled out this technology, and this guy actually was making biodiesel from turkey feathers.
Exactly. Yeah, they make it from anything.
Yeah, I mean, he said this is the solution to the waste that's produced by our factory farms. The anything organic, anything that has carbon in it,
right,
including plastics.
Yeah, everything
can be converted into biodiesel. Yeah,
yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
And
so
because California does get half our oil is foreign oil. And we need to do something. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a big problem here. So we really need to, I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, I would think step one would be to in Los Angeles, to start replacing the highways or a chunk of those highways with a mass transit system.
We are. Well, in the 50s, Polson said no to the Bank of America went to Polson, and Disneyland went to Polson, and stated, "We'll build a rapid transit from Disneyland to the heart of L.A." And Polson said no, and it was privately funded. It would have been privately owned, and that would have been the first thought. To now, we're paying billions of dollars to have all this rapid transit put in. We are doing it, but it's costing the taxpayers. You can't believe how much it's costing.
Was Polson the governor at the time?
No, he was mayor of L.A.
Mayor of L.A., I see.
Yeah, and it was my father just about fell off the floor. He was so upset.
Well, the other big history, of course, is that Los Angeles actually from 1900 to the 1930s had a very, very good, one of the nation's best mass transit systems. A trolley car system.
The trolley cars, yeah. I'm dating myself. I shouldn't do this.
that ran all over the city. And
well, I wasn't that old.
But General Motors and Firestone came in and said to the city, let us buy this thing and run it, and we'll run it more efficiently. The city sold the two of them, and what did they do? They tore it up and threw it away.
Oh, yeah. Hindsight's always better than foresight.
Yeah, and in fact, they were both convicted in court of a criminal conspiracy doing that. So.
That's right. Anyway, Judy, I just wanted to pass that on.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Judy. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Eric in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Eric?
Well, I just have to refute the nonsense that Mr. Avery had on his show. I'm a farmer here in Montana, and what he said about soybeans being better than canola is wrong. Mm-hmm. Soybeans actually have a higher oil content per bushel. The problem with canola is you can't grow them in the majority of the U.S. cold climate crop. It has to grow out here on the northern tier.
Right, right.
And his organization is sponsored by the large oil companies. Anything that's not oil is obviously wrong.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
That was the point I was making. I mean, they're growing canola like crazy up in Canada and biodiesel and other things as well. I mean, anything that's heavy in oil, you can make it into plastics. You can make it into all kinds of stuff.
Right. There's a new crop that we're working on here in Montana. It's called camelina. And it's actually even got a higher efficiency than canola. It's just new. There's not a lot known about it right now. And
it's a new hybrid.
Problem there is the oil from it is high in omega-3, so it's probably got a higher value as a food than it does as a biodiesel until we get enough acres of it growing.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. What, any sense, Eric, of the kind of yield that you've got per acre? Number of gallons of oil per acre?
On a dry land situation here in Montana, we're looking at about 1,000 pounds of the camelina, about 40.
Eric? Oh, we've lost Eric. Well, he must have been calling on his cell phone. Anyhow, 1-866-440-8466. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, on a giant arc of paradigm shift, wanted to point out that the problem isn't that we go to either nuclear or biofuels. We need to go from energy consumers to energy producers. We need to, whether it's put a windmill in your backyard, I heard one statistic once that if everybody put 20 to 30% of their roofs as a photovoltaic cell and other energy efficiency, you know, actions, they could make their homes independently energy self-sufficient.
This is what Germany is doing right now.
I've
told the story on the program. The last time I was in Germany was last November, and I hadn't been there in, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, something. It had been a little while. Usually I try to make it back there every year. And taking the train from Frankfurt to Steinach or to Kulmbach, the end of the train route that I was taking, is about a 4-hour ride east to west across the country, or west to east rather. And I was sitting on the north side of the train, and I'm looking up at the south side of the hillsides and the south facing roofs of all these houses and all these red tile roofs. And about 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 houses was covered with solar cells. And when I get to Steinach, Samuel Mueller, my friend there, says, hey, you got to see that. And his roof has got this giant solar panel on it. And the deal is that the government said that the banks are required to offer a 10-year mortgage at a very low rate. It's like a 1 or 2% rate, something like that. And the government makes up the difference. So the banks are not losing money on this. They're required to offer a mortgage to people to put solar panels on their houses. The solar panels, then the power companies are required to buy electricity from those solar panels at 7 times the prevailing electricity rate. Now it sounds like that would cause them to lose money, but the amount of power that's being generated by these solar panels is enough to pay for the cost of building a new nuclear power plant. And so by paying just 7 times the normal rate over a 10-year period, they're going to end up with the equivalent of a brand new nuclear power plant, or several of them, and it's going to cost them over a 10-year period less than it would cost to build a nuclear power plant. And at the end of 10 years, because you're getting 7 times the electric cost back, that pays the mortgage. In fact, some people are actually making a small profit on this. And at the end of 10 years, the bank is paid off. You're not out of pocket at all. You might even have a small profit. And you've got a roof that generates electricity that has a 50-year lifespan.
There's also other alternatives, too. People can put small, efficient geothermal generators for their homes. They're heating their homes with geothermal. They're doing all kinds, whether it's biofuels, there's all sorts of different ways people can generate energy, not even just solar, not even just wind. There's so many alternatives to generate energy that we don't have to be energy consumers, and that's the threat to the oil companies.
Yeah.
That's the threat to big energy like nuclear power. They don't want us to be producing our own energy. They want to keep a centralized monopoly on the production of energy.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, they're out of business.
Absolutely, and they want it centralized, and they want centralized distribution. I wrote a piece for Marianne Williams, did an anthology called Imagine What America Could Be Like in 50 Years. This is about, 6 or 7 years ago it came out. And the piece that I wrote was about communities becoming energy self-sufficient. And I think it's so important. I think it is absolutely one of the keys, not only to America's survival as we go through peak oil and everything else, but also to bringing peace to the world, because so many of the wars in the world right now are around oil. They happen to be in oil-producing regions. Richard, thanks for the call. Pam in Lakewood. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Of course, I have a comment about Avery, and I can't compete with his research, but I don't know where he gets his particular research, but I can't. I just my gut just can't agree with a lot of his opinions. Plus, I caught a piece of an interview on either your show or Franken's show from a guy who talked about using grasses, and including
sawgrass. It was actually George Bush who was talking about that.
It was George Bush?
Yeah, George Bush went out west, and he was talking about how we can make biodiesel out of sawgrass.
He got
isn't it
from
it a great
the
thing?
Same guy that was on Franken's show interview. But anyway, one of the things that we also – and he talks about taking forests down to produce all this oil. What about all the oil we've already made that just gets thrown away in restaurants that are only very, very tiny parts of it are getting reclaimed? I mean, if we had a wholesale reclamation of the oils that are being used for cooking that get thrown out.
Well, again, they're doing that in Germany. When Samuel picked me up at the train station, as we took the bags around to the back, he was driving a diesel Volkswagen station wagon. And we're putting the bags in the back, and he said, smell the tailpipe? And I'm like, no, I smell something that smells like French fries.
Right.
He's like, that's the tailpipe.
Like French fries before, and because we can even get it in like Central Oregon, you can go to stations that sell recycled oil from restaurants, but it's only done on piecemeal. But I mean, there's huge amounts of it. I see.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't buy the idea that I just don't buy what he says. I just can't.
Neither do I. But he's out there doing the circuit with all the right wing talk shows in particular, and it's something that I think we need to know about. We need to know what the right wing's talking points are so that we can refute them.
Yeah.
Tragically, Pam, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. Man, it's amazing what's going on here. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls here in just a minute. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the true people's radio, the radio home of democracy. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Yes, you are a listener. Support this program. Let your radio station know you like the program if you're listening, and let our sponsors know and patronize their products. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, sacredgroundscoffee.com, saving the planet one cup at a time, all organic, all fair trade, 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, www.smalldog.com. Tony in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
I got a lot of calls on this energy issue, huh?
Yeah.
I have a degree in appropriate technology, and I don't agree with Mr. Avery. If he's still listening, I don't think people are really buying what he had to say. And as for fossil fuels, I'm not really buying them anymore. No one is suggesting that we cut down our forests to grow crops for biofuels. I run my truck on 90% biodiesel right now. My source reclaims used oil from the restaurants in our town, and this actually saves land by reducing the landfill.
But what happens when, you know, 400 or 500 million cars in the United States are all running on biodiesel?
Well, that's my next thing. This is a real solution today, and it's a part of a multi-point strategy to improve things.
Yeah.
I'm basically putting money in the pocket of a local business run by guys I went to school with, and I couldn't be more proud of it. I personally recommend that we should, as a nation, utilize hemp seeds because, you know, hemp is a really, you know, that's a
it's
whole nother
great
topic.
Oil crop.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We're not using it here because of the heel draggers.
Knuckle draggers, you mean.
Yeah.
In fact, back in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are written on hemp paper. And in all probability, their evening sessions, they were reading by lamps that were lit with hemp oil.
Choir here.
Yeah.
As for his moronic nuclear solution, I will agree to it only if Dennis Avery agrees we could store the waste in his backyard.
Well, that sounds like a plan. Thank you very much, Tony. Dave in Los Angeles, you think that we should store the waste in Nevada?
You know, Tom, I was thinking about this for a long time, and I think what we ought to do, it may sound overly simplistic, but build an array of nukes in Nevada, on the Nevada testing ground. The land's already contaminated. Yucca Mountain is already there. And then we could use those, cut in Bechtel, Fluor, Parsons, these people, to build a tunnel or a pipeline to bring in water, and then create hydrogen. Go to the fuel cell, and then cut in ExxonMobil to do the distribution. These people, you know, they're
why?
Like,
why do you want to have these centralized systems? Why not have every community generate their own electricity? Why shouldn't I put a roof on my house that's made out of solar panels? They're actually being manufactured and sold by Sony right now. Or not Sony, Sanyo. Why shouldn't I put a roof on my house that's solar panels and generate my own electricity?
I agree with you. That is the better solution. Unfortunately, the resistance from these folks is going to prevent that from happening.
Well,
so
see, that's our job, is to blow away that resistance, is to point out, you know, what their talking points and show how they're nonsense.
I say deal them in, deal in these corporations, and go the path of least resistance and get it here the quickest.
No, because 17% of all electricity in the United States is lost just from line losses. You start moving electricity over long distances, you're going to have huge line losses. If you're going to try and move it around as hydrogen, you're going to have losses from converting the electricity to hydrogen in the hydrolysis process. We still haven't dealt with the problem of what are we going to do with the spent fuel. You're creating, target ground zero for any kind of disaster. You have any of these nukes that melt down and the entire Midwest and eastern seaboard of the United States becomes uninhabitable for 250,000 years. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm not buying it.
Well, I don't want it run by Homer Simpson, and I would want it highly regulated.
Right.
And they're in our backyard. We can watch them.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the contribution. Patsy in Tacoma. Hey, Patsy.
Actually, it's Fircrest, Tom, but I don't know if you're familiar with Green Fuel Technologies in Boston, Massachusetts.
The company?
But, yeah, the company.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm sorry.
Oh, let me brief you very – I'm not, you know, up on it totally, but what they do is they convert CO2 with algae, and it produces oil,
using algae to pull the carbon out of the atmosphere and make hydrocarbon fuels out of that.
Yeah, they put it on top of smokestacks and things in Canada. They're starting to do it.
Huh, interesting. To recover the CO2, you mean?
Yeah, to recover this, and then the algae increases, it sops it up.
Yeah,
Yeah. And then they convert it into oil.
Fascinating. Biological conversions. I know that there's a lot of work being done on catalytic conversions, you know, where you've got a set of metals or things that will cause chemical reactions but not participate in them so they can stand in one place. But
get a chance, look up green fuel in Boston. You'd be find it really interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Charles in Ohio, driving in Ohio. Charles, we just have a few seconds left. Quick point you wanted to make?
CoatsEngines.com shows you a more efficient way to produce engines now to run on this biodiesel. And,
okay.
I really don't have time to go into it right now, Tom, but I wanted to talk to you about what we can do about maintaining control of our government once we get it back. Otherwise, it'll be a momentary lapse.
Give me a shout tomorrow, Charles. Progress. Give me a shout tomorrow, and we'll get into it. How's that?
Okay, that'll work.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thank you very much. Coming up next, Amy Goodman, democracynow.org. She has a new book out. We'll be talking about government liars, media cheerleaders, the people who fight back. That, we're going to get into what's happening with Korea and Iran. And, of course, as always, taking your calls at 1-866-440-8466. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Government liars, media cheerleaders, and the people who fight back. The subtitle of Amy Goodman's new book, Static. Amy, the host of Democracy Now. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Amy Goodman on the line with us. Hey, Amy.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
It's always wonderful to have you on our program, and I strongly, strongly encourage all of my listeners to watch Democracy Now for their as a primary news source. You are the Edward R. Murrow, the Walter Cronkite, you're stronger than they were, frankly.
Well, I just have to say I work with a remarkable team of people every day who produce Democracy Now, and that's what makes it all possible. And, you know, all of the independent media in this country, we just need a different kind of media, a media that covers power, not covers for power, a media that truly is the fourth estate, not for the state.
Yeah, well said, well said. So in your new book, Static, which you wrote with your brother David, and the subtitle, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back, you start right out, Outlaw Nation, Chapter 1. Outlaw Nation?
Yes. Unfortunately, that is the case. And we make the case with a man who actually is in the news today. His name is Maher Arar. He was a Canadian citizen, 2002. He was coming back from summer vacation through Kennedy Airport up to Canada. And there he was at Kennedy, taken by U.S. authorities, put in a U.S. jail. And then the authorities said they were going to deport him to Syria. Now, here is a man who was born in Syria, left when he was 17, fled with his family, said he would be tortured if he was sent there, but the U.S. government sent him anyway on one of those Gulfstream jets on a torture flight. He cries all the way to Syria, where he's put in a grave-like cell. He's brutalized. He's tortured. He's interrogated. He's held for almost a year, and then as inexplicably as he was taken, he was released, a broken man to Canada. In the last few weeks, a Canadian Judicial Commission slammed the United States, said Maher Arar was an innocent man, and now Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, has just lodged a protest with the U.S. government. I mean, this is called extraordinary rendition. What an extraordinary term. It's White House for kidnapping. Now, if the U.S. engages in kidnapping, in Italy right now, the prosecutors are weighing bringing charges against about two dozen CIA agents for kidnapping a sheikh off the streets of Milan and sending him off to Egypt. Kidnapping, torture, as we know from Abu Ghraib to Bagram to the black sites we don't even know about, the prisons that President Bush admitted exist. to illegal detentions. I mean, thousands of people have been detained since 9/11. We don't know their names. They don't know the charges against them. Many of them have been deported. This does not represent the best of America. I don't think that most Americans think of themselves as living in an outlaw nation. But if we pride ourselves on being a model of practice and behavior, what's going to happen if some U.S. citizen or a U.S. official or a soldier is captured somewhere else and the captors say, we're going to do it the American way? This increases our national insecurity.
Well, and for that matter, since we're capturing, we're kidnapping people on the streets of other countries, they could come here and say, oh, Amy Goodman, she's talking bad about France. We're going to kidnap her and send her off to Algeria to be tortured. And boom, you vanish.
That's right. You know,
and they would say, well, we're just doing what America does. And the fact of the matter is, Maharar is, he was let go. I mean, we don't have, that might have been an anomaly. We have no idea how many people have disappeared. We don't even know how many people who are American citizens who are disappeared. Jose Padilla, or Padilla, and what was the other guy's name? The U.S. citizen who was also, Hamdi?
Yeah.
Hamdi. U.S. citizens. I mean, that was leaked to the news media when the federal government was asked, you know, are there other American citizens who are? Well, it's a state secret. I mean, we don't. They could be kidnapped. We could be disappearing people in the United States right now.
It's very frightening. And, you know, Tom, I mean, just in the last 2 weeks, U.S. Congress voting that hooding, stripping, hypothermia are in, and habeas corpus is out.
Yeah, this is not the America that frankly I think 230 years worth of Americans fought, died for, believed in, and that people all over the world modeled their democracies after.
That's right.
And
also, I mean, this is why I think lines are breaking down between conservatives and liberals. If you believe in law and order, then you believe if there is evidence against someone that they are guilty of something, that the evidence should be gathered, they should be charged, they should be tried, and if found guilty, they should be punished. What is happening when all of this is breaking down right now? And, I mean, the White House understands fully what they're doing because at the same time they're changing these laws, the White House is working on changing the 1996 War Crimes Act.
Right.
I'm not talking Geneva Conventions. I'm talking about U.S. law.
Right.
Changing it because they're afraid they will be held accountable according to our current laws.
And well, they should. Joseph Goebbels made the comment that It is not just within the capability of the state, but it is the obligation of the state to shape and form public opinion. And the third chapter of your book, News Fakers. Let's talk about this, the forming of public opinion in America.
I mean, it is so important to understand how low the media has gone. We talk about news fakers because... Well, we start with I.F. Stone, the muckraking journalist who says all governments lie, but disaster lies in wait for countries whose officials smoke the same hashish they give out. And there we talk about the number of journalists who are on the government payroll. We talk about both in the United States and also in Iraq. I mean, there is a company that was founded by a West Point dropout, had no previous experience, Lincoln Group, that gets tens of millions of dollars to plant the stories secretly written by the U.S. military in Iraqi papers to pay off publishers, editors, reporters. So you have these so-called good news stories. The Iraqis don't believe them because they know the reality on the ground, which means they start to disbelieve their own media, which undermines democracy because free press is critical to the functioning of a democracy. Ask Thomas Jefferson, who said if he had the choice of government or a free press, he would choose the latter. So you have the undermining of it in Iraq. And then, of course, we don't have borders in the world anymore in this globalized world. So then you have U.S. newspapers picking up these planted stories and repeating them there. And I would argue that that's probably the target audience, not even Iraq.
That's why they were
back
in
home.
The first place.
Right. And this is a serious breach of what the tenets of this country were built on. There's a reason our profession, journalism, is the only one protected by the U.S. Constitution, because it's essential to the functioning of a democratic society. You know, we go on in the book. We have a chapter called Mighty Wurlitzer, where we look back at the history of CIA involvement in the press in this country, and I think it would really shock people. It is hardly talked about, but it is absolutely critical for people to understand. I mean, back between the 50s and the 70s, there were hundreds of news organizations that were involved with the CIA. You had among the chief executives who helped the CIA, William Paley of CBS, Henry Luce of Time, Arthur Sulzberger of the New York Times, Barry Bingham Singer of the Louisville Courier Journal, James Copley of the Copley News Service, the leading TV networks, including ABC and NBC, the Wire Services, AP, UPI, Reuters, along with Hearst Newspapers, Scripps Howard, Newsweek, the Miami Herald, Saturday Evening Post, all had dealings with the spy agency. The CIA's most valuable associations were with the New York Times, CBS, and Time Magazine. The person who really
Judith Miller writ large.
Was Carl Bernstein.
I beg your pardon?
The person who really exposed this many years ago in Rolling Stone was Carl Bernstein, who had worked with Bob Woodward in exposing the Watergate scandal for the Washington Post.
Yeah, this is Judith Miller writ large, only at an institutional level. I have years ago I read an expose, and I've always wondered about the accuracy of it, that ABC as a network was actually brought into being by people affiliated with the CIA specifically to get the message out. Do you know about that?
Well, I mean, ABC is owned by Disney now. And before that, it was Cap Cities, and Cap Cities among those were the, I think was head of the people in Cap Cities was, wasn't it Casey, who was the head of the CIA under Reagan?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a fascinating, but I never pursued it, and so in any case, the new book by Amy Goodman and David Goodman, Static Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. Amy, the host of Democracy Now. Amy, you're on a book tour with this thing. Is there a website for it?
Yeah, we're on an 80-city book tour. It's a little bit frightening. Tomorrow night we'll be in Buffalo. Then this weekend we'll be in Tucson. We'll be in Pittsburgh. We'll be in Cleveland and other places. People can go to our website at democracynow.org and check it all out.
Great. Thank you very much. Amy Goodman, democracynow.org, the website, the book, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. Carry on the good fight, Amy.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
So that's how it is. That's what we got. If the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Yes, indeed, my friends, the middle class screwed. Ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on the American middle class, that war getting quite successful. I'll be talking about that Friday night, by the way, Friday the 13th, October 13th. The doors open at 6 p.m. I'll be there early to say hi and sign books. Speech at 7 o'clock in Eugene, Oregon, at the South Eugene High School Auditorium. It's hosted by Breakfast with Nancy host Nancy Stapp on KOPT. And the Democratic Party Lane County will be there. Refreshments served in the lobby, Q&A afterwards. So if you are in the Eugene, Oregon area listening to us on KOPT, which is carrying our program live right this moment, consider Friday night, 6 o'clock. Should be a hoot at the South Eugene High School Auditorium. Also, just a heads up, on Sunday this weekend, October 15th, I'll give you Eastern time, and you can translate into whatever time zone you're in, because we're broadcasting live all across the country right now. At 11:30 Eastern time, from 11:30 to 1, and then in the morning, and then again from 10:30 p.m. until, what would that be, 10:30, 11:30, until midnight, Eastern time on C-SPAN 2, which is their book TV channel, they will have an hour and a half of me, oddly enough, following Bill O'Reilly. 30 minutes of Bill O'Reilly doing his Culture Warrior, his new book, and then an hour and a half of me talking about This is a videotape of the speech that Mark Crispin Miller introduces me, and he and I take questions at the end together, of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And you'll find that at C-SPAN Book TV, C-SPAN Channel 2 on Sunday. And if you just want to check out the schedule, booktv.org/schedule will get you that information.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. So anyhow, the two faces of Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, sat on the board of a company. This is from The Guardian. For some reason, the British newspapers are all over this story. I have not yet seen an American newspaper pick this story up. But this from The Guardian. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, sat on the board of a company which 3 years ago sold two light water nuclear reactors to North Korea. Just let me give you the time on this. This article ran in 2003. Excuse me. That might be why no American newspapers are picking it up right now. In 2003, The Guardian ran the story. So this was Rumsfeld was on the board before he was appointed Secretary of Defense. Don Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, sat on the board of a company which 3 years ago sold two light water nuclear reactors to North Korea, a country he now regards as part of the axis of evil and which has been targeted for regime change by Washington because of its efforts to build nuclear weapons. Mr. Rumsfeld was a non-executive director of ABB, a European engineering giant based in Zurich, when it won a $200 million contract to provide the design and key components for the reactors for North Korea. The current defense secretary sat on the board from 1990 to 2001, earning $190,000 a year. He left to join the Bush administration. They go on to say the sale of the nuclear technology was a high-profile contract. ABB's then-chief executive, Goran Landahl, visited North Korea in November 1999 to announce ABB's wide-ranging long-term cooperation agreement with the communist government. The company also opened an office in that country's capital, Pyongyang, and the deal was signed a year later in 2000. Interestingly, Rumsfeld says, I don't know anything about this. One unnamed ABB board director told Fortune magazine that Mr. Rumsfeld, I'm quoting again here from The Guardian, was involved in lobbying his hawkish friends on behalf of ABB. The type of reactors involved in the ABB deal produce plutonium, which needs refining before it can be weaponized. One U.S. congressman and critic of the North Korean regime described the reactors as nuclear bomb factories. And those reactors apparently provided exploded yesterday. Assuming that that was actually a nuclear blast, it appears it was. It might have not gone off quite as well as they had hoped, but it was apparently a nuclear bomb. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Evan in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Evan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was really enjoying the program today, and I had a couple thoughts. One on the alternative energy. With factory farms today, we produce large amounts of biofuels in the state of Calpu.
Yeah.
And we could
and other wastes.
And Strauss Dairy down in California has converted their farm to collect all that, and they're burning the methane in a electric generator and saving themselves, I think, $6,000 a month, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of potential there. And I'd like to reiterate what you were saying about hemp being a superior crop.
Oh, it's very, very potent stuff. And, Evan, I know that you called about something else altogether. Let me just put you on hold, and we'll pick that up on the other side of the break. It's time now for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question is, which Bush administration official was on the board of the company that sold nuclear reactors to North Korea? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM 440-8466 gets an autographed copy of Screwed.
What gives you the right, hey you, to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me who gave you the power to stop me from living like I do? Remember, if you plan to stay, those who give and take away, don't bite the hand that feeds you.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, which Bush administration official was on the board of a company that sold nuclear reactors to North Korea that ultimately were used to produce the plutonium that blew up day before yesterday. And congratulations to Donald Bright from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Listening on our affiliate WPTT there in Pittsburgh, he knew that the correct answer is Donald Rumsfeld. Boy, Don Rumsfeld, he's brought us so many fine things. You know, Don Rumsfeld also brought us aspartame. He was president of G.D. Searle, the big pharmaceutical and chemical manufacturer, and aspartame got turned down by the FDA, or so the story goes. I'm assuming it's true. I've read it in multiple places. Got turned down, and he went back and lobbied. As I recall, it was the Bush senior administration. Might have been the Reagan administration. And said, make this stuff legal. And they were like, well, it kind of breaks down to formaldehyde. And it's some problems here with it. No, let's make it legal. So, wonder of wonders, we have aspartame. Anyway, we were talking with Evan in Olympia. Hey, Evan.
Yeah, I believe it's at 86 or 96 degrees that it turns to formaldehyde.
Yeah, it's not real high because during Gulf War I, they had a big problem with a whole bunch of soft drinks that were taken in on pallets, diet soft drinks that sat out in the desert heat, and the artificial sweetener apparently became toxic, and they had, at least this is the story. Again, these may be like Vanishing Hitchhiker stories. They may be apocryphal. I'm not an expert. I'm not presenting myself as an expert on this, but this is what I've seen reported.
What I wanted to say was that it was really great to hear Amy. Usually she has that kind of Noam Chomsky kind of monotone, and it was good to hear all the emotion in her voice. And I think she's just a great bringer of good news to so many people that wouldn't get out otherwise.
I agree. Amy and I were the two keynote speakers for the AFL-CIO convention last year in Chicago. We've been on panels together at Bioneers. In fact, I think we will be again in October on a panel together at Bioneers. Her brother David lives in Vermont. I used to live in Vermont. I didn't know him particularly well, but we share a lot of friends, and I just have a lot of respect for Amy.
Yeah, Gunn. She's been to Olympia, and she's coming back real soon, actually, in the next couple weeks here.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say was that about 6 months ago, maybe, and I hate to disparage another, AM 1090 host, but
don't do so by name, because it just wouldn't be right.
Well, there was a caller that called up on a show. And they were saying, I knew the war was a lie before because I was listening to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now. And the host said, I don't listen to a thing that Amy Goodman says. And then he hung up on her.
Yeah.
And I was just, I could not believe it.
Well, I didn't hear it. B, I have no idea why any host would respond that way.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I catch her on the web because otherwise I couldn't hear the first hour of your show because we hear Democracy Now! Here in Olympia at 9.
Yeah,
so.
Amy Goodman is great, and Democracy Now! is a great program, and the only thing I can guess is that perhaps he had her mixed up with somebody else. But, in any case, I prefer not to talk about other talk show hosts on this program. Let's see here. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, before I get to my point about Bush v. Gore, I was thinking before when you were talking about your book, Screwed, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure it's like a lot of other important books where if, enough people got out together and actually read it, what you talk about would translate into real change. So I think
that's why I wrote it.
Well, my thing is, the obstacle is how do we actually get enough people and the right people in mass to read a book like yours and similar books?
Well, for my part, I tried to write a book that was very easy to read. I mean, it's the kind of book that it is more or less kind of in story form. There's a lot of examples and stories in it. It's not long.
That's the most you can do, but you see my point. I mean, unless you're people like me and your audience, you go out of your way to pay attention to stuff like that.
Yeah.
Come on, how many people do you actually expect to read it?
Well, the fact of the matter is that about 10% of Americans will buy one book a year, about 2% of Americans will buy more than one book a year, and about 10% of the books that are purchased are actually read. So, the statistics are not encouraging.
we need to find another. We need to have a book that says, how do we get people to read the right books?
So. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that also, there was a Swedish economist who back in the 40s or 50s came up with a theory that suggested, and I believe that now it's named after him. It's one of these kind of obscure things that that statisticians and sociologists know about. And I'm neither one, so I don't, you know, can't remember all the details of it. But he came up with this theory that there was a decider class, essentially, a class of people in society who end up being the influencers of society by and large, and that they don't know each other. It's not like a conspiracy. And it's not an economic class, and it's not even necessarily an educational class. There's just this group of people in society who are wired in such a way that they network with a lot of people. And Gladwell talked about this in The Tipping Point to some extent. And who also have a certain, you know, level of curiosity and interest in what's going on in the world. And if you can reach that class of people, that group of people, you can actually produce social change. And that group of people is a relatively small number of people, 5 to 20% of the population, depending on the size of the society and how you define the group. And so, I never give up hope. I mean,
the answer would be you ought to get yourself on Oprah's book club list.
Yeah, well, that would be nice, but it's not the kind of book that she puts on her book club list. But, you know, it's here's what I'm seeing right now, Jay, is we don't in the United States elect leaders. We elect representatives. And even though most people don't know that at the level of, you know, intellectual certainty, it's true, and they know it in their gut. And politicians, by and large, you know, there's some politicians who get out in front of things. You know, Jim McDermott, for example, up in Seattle, coming out against the Iraq war even before it happened. He wasn't prescient. I mean, he went over there, he looked around, and he said, you know, this is not something we want to have a war over. He understood the situation. He did his homework. But the fact of the matter is, by and large, what happens is when enough people, enough of the rabble, you know, you and me, enough people get energized about an issue, whether it's national health care, or whether it's ending a war, or the death of the middle class, or whatever it may be, when enough people get energized about an issue, they, for all practical purposes, create this parade that's running down the street, and the politicians will notice the parade, and they'll say, hey, there's a parade, I better get in front of that parade. And then, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later, we're looking back going, hey, that politician was leading that parade. But it's always the other way around. Teddy Roosevelt was elected as a rich, white, conservative Republican, member of the ruling class, as Vice President of the United States back in 1896, I believe the election was, as Vice President to McKinley. And when McKinley was assassinated in 1900 and Roosevelt became president, by that time, the progressive and populist movements in the United States, the Wobblies and the Grange movement, this whole confluence, the suffrage movement, all of this had reached critical mass, and Teddy Roosevelt got it. And I don't think he even did it at a Machiavellian level. I don't think he looked around and said, you know, I better become a progressive or I'll lose my political base. I think he woke up because so many people around him had awakened. And that's our job, is to create the parade, is to awaken as many Americans as we can. And if we do that, the politicians will follow us. That's why, frankly, I'm not afraid or not concerned about politicians with whom I disagree ending up in political office, with whom I disagree on many issues. Because I think if we can get enough of the people to understand the issues, understand that free trade is a scam.
Big if. Operative word if.
Well, it's not an if. If you look at the history of the United States, it has always worked that way. It has always worked that way. The beginning of the rise of corporate power and laissez-faire economics in the United States was in the 1870s. It was dead by 1900. That was just 30 years later. Teddy Roosevelt came along and started putting the nail in the coffin of those guys, ripping apart corporations, big corporate giants. He was called the Trust Buster. He's still referred to that way, you know, that way in history. And then, you know, for 15, 20 years, we had the progressive era in the United States, the first part of the 20th century, the 1900s. And we got in 1913 direct election of the Senate so that we had more say in how things are done. A whole bunch of states, I think 23 states, as I recall, passed amendments to their constitution to provide for things like the ballot initiative process in California so people could get directly involved in democracy. You had the women were brought in to vote, you know, the women's suffrage movement, the passage of the 20th Amendment in 1919, as I recall, maybe it was 1917. All of these things happened in a relatively short period of time. And then we slid back into another corporate era from basically 1920 to 1932. And that that corporate reign only lasted less than 20 years. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, I'm going to blow this apart. Another wealthy white power guy, from the powered elite, who ran on a very conservative platform, frankly. And yet once he got into power, he realized the American people, that's not where the American people were at. And he underwent a transformation. Franklin Roosevelt did. And so I just, we're 26 years now. If you track this thing back to the election of Reagan in the election of 1980, his installation in 1981, we're 25, 26 years into it. It has never lasted longer than this before.
Well, I would still liken it to a tree. I mean, liken it to a tree. A tree takes, 50 years to full growth, but you can knock it down in 10 minutes. And I just feel like we got an administration that's already knocked the tree down.
No, it's the other way around. We are the ones who are the knockers, as it were. This administration is fallen. They're going down fast, Jay. They really are, trust me. 45 minutes past the hour.
It's all good. It's all right. Lord, it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't
Welcome back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Snopes.com, the great debunking website, claim the artificial sweetener aspartame has been proved responsible for an epidemic of cancer, brain tumors, and multiple sclerosis status. False. Now, I don't see where it specifically says that it doesn't break down to formaldehyde, but anyhow, I represent myself as, claim to be, or whatever, an expert on aspartame. Or Don Rumsfeld, for that matter. Several people have called to ask, what was the title of that article about Don Rumsfeld that ran in The Guardian? It was the May 9th, 2003 edition of The Guardian. You can easily track it down. It's called The Two Faces of Rumsfeld, was the title of the article. And I believe that BuzzFlash.com is linking to it right now. I may be wrong, but I believe that that's where this came from. David, do you recall? Did this come off BuzzFlash, The Two Faces of Rumsfeld?
Yes.
Okay. So check out BuzzFlash.com. If you can't easily find it there, it's called The Two Faces of Rumsfeld. Guardian, the Guardian of UK. It's guardian.co.uk, guardian.co.uk. And you can just search for that article, May 9, 2003. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., our official senior slapped down correspondent. You got slapped down, Victoria?
I did, yeah.
Well, physically?
Like that. Well, no, not physically. No, it was Tony Snow, so he wouldn't do a thing like that. But I asked a very reasonable question about the three important polls that come out today. I was the only person, by the way, at this morning's gaggle to ask a non-North Korea question.
Wow, how strange.
Everybody's caught up in North Korea, and I think politics is also important.
Well, I want to find out about your question, but lest I forget, forgive my
ADD moment
here. Let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there has been any discussion in any of the gaggles or press conferences or whatever about the USS Eisenhower and its all the ships associated with it that are steaming their way towards the Persian Gulf right now, estimated to arrive on October 21st. And the rumbles in the blogosphere and in the media and from families of people who are aboard some of these ships that they're very upset that they may be being sent to start a war with Iran in order to help the Republicans get elected in 2006.
Not a word.
Not a word. Have you heard that?
I had not heard that.
Okay. The press reports I'm seeing is that, in fact, it is that battle group is on its way, but that it may be going to simply replace the USS Enterprise battle group that would be then leaving the area. On the other hand, if they both stay in the area, then maybe we've got a problem. So,
yeah.
Anyhow, what was the question you asked Tony today?
Well, the several new polls are out showing the president's ratings below 40%, some as low as 34%. Even though the president says he doesn't read polls, he must nevertheless be aware of this. Is he not concerned? So then I said, and voters are saying that they will use their congressional vote to vote against the president. 3-1 and 2-1, they're saying this. I phrased it a bit better than this at the time. Number one, is the president aware of this? And number two, is he concerned about being a drag on the Republican ticket?
Mm-hmm.
And he said yes and no.
Oh, really?
And then went on to the next question.
Yes and no.
He did.
This is one of the things they teach you over at Fox News, you know?
I know.
Well, we're not about news. We're about Fox.
What mean?
I'm sorry that you got slapped down, McCoy.
I got slapped down.
I'm even sorrier that the American people did not get a straight answer to a decent question.
Well, fortunately, when I asked this question this morning I got a very expansive answer to that question, and this afternoon I just got that, which made me think that he regretted the answer he gave me this morning. But there were four follow-ups from other members of the press this afternoon, so he couldn't dodge it.
Uh-huh. And ultimately, what was the answer?
There really wasn't one.
He continued to weasel. Yeah,
it was blather.
So everything was all about North Korea. So what's the big news about North Korea?
About North Korea is that they seem to be downplaying it without admitting that they're downplaying it. They seem to be saying that maybe it was something old and off the shelf. They're almost saying maybe it wasn't nuclear. But when you actually ask them that, they won't say that. But they won't verify that it was a nuclear test.
Interesting. Did anybody point out that in 2003, The Guardian ran an article titled "The Two Faces of Rumsfeld," in which they talked about how in the year 2000, before the elections, Don Rumsfeld was on the board of ABB, the company that sold the reactors that produced the plutonium that blew up day before yesterday in Korea to Korea.
No, but I wish you'd send me the article, or at least send me, where can I find it?
Can you make a quick note?
Yep.
It's May 9, 2003.
Yep.
Guardian.co.uk.
Yep.
Title of the article, "The Two Faces of Rumsfeld."
Okay.
And then the subhead, 2000, director of a company which wins $200 million contract to sell nuclear reactors to North Korea. 2002, declares North Korea a terrorist state, part of the axis of evil, and a target for regime change.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I said. That's why I had to share it with our
listeners. Yeah, that's a wow moment.
I mean, it's like, yeah, well, it's just like George W. Bush saying, well, we know that they've got chemical weapons over there in Iraq. My daddy sold them to him. Oops.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my.
Oh.
Well, the North Korea, well, we're out of time here. The North Korea situation is one that it almost seems like a diversion. But do you see any prospect that the Bush administration will actually start directly negotiating with these guys?
No.
None. That's
as Tony Snow would say, no and no.
Yeah, that's tragic. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Victoria, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, exposing the con in conservative 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The Tom Hartman program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Or should we say Reich-wing? You know, we all have to learn how to pronounce this stuff correctly if we're really going to move into the new era. The brave new world, the thousand points of light, the new world order. Nah, it's imploding. I'm telling you, it's imploding. I know.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Yes. Yes, I'm telling you, I know. By the way, Dave Lindorf, the co-author of The Case for Impeachment, writing, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier Eisenhower and its accompanied strike force of cruiser, destroyer, and attack submarines slipped their moorings and headed off to the Persian Gulf region on October 2nd, as I predicted in a piece in The Nation magazine a few weeks back. The Eisenhower Strike Force, according to my sources, is scheduled to arrive in the vicinity of Iran around October 21, at the same time as a second flotilla of minesweeps and other ships. This buildup of naval power around the coast of Iran, according to some military sources, is in preparation for an air attack on Iran that would target not just Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, but its entire military command and control system. While such an attack could be expected to unleash a wave of military violence all over Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and elsewhere against American forces and interests, and against oil wells, pipelines, and loading facilities, well, maybe not. I mean, you know, maybe Bush will, when he makes the announcement, he'll say the same thing he did when he invaded Iraq, right?
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And they listened to him that time, so, you know, maybe they will again. Anyhow, he's predicting it's going to unleash an orgy of violence against our interests, including oil wells, pipelines, and loading facilities, and as well as the mining of the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz, with a resulting skyrocketing of global oil prices. The real goal of this new war by the U.S. would be ensuring, so this was a very long sentence. He goes through, he says, while such an attack, and then he goes through all the stuff that I just read to you, and then he says, while such an attack, blah, 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 the real goal of this new war by the U.S. would be ensuring Republican control of the House and Senate. And now, a year or so ago, I wrote a piece, an op-ed piece for Common Dreams. You can find it over at TomHartmann.com. Click Articles on Democracy, called They Died So Bush Lied. No. They Died So Republicans Could Get Reelected. And that was my whole point. The original 2003 invasion of Iraq was so that Bush could get reelected in 2004. It was a purely partisan effort. And it looks like they're about to do it again. It is the exact same playbook as the 2002 playbook. Karl Rove knows a few tricks, and he knows them very well. And as Dave Lindorf points out, the co-author of The Case for Impeachment, he says, the sailing of the Eisenhower has been pushed forward recently by about a month by the Pentagon, and he thinks it's for clearly political reasons. He said, key will be what happens with the Enterprise Carrier Strike Force, which has already been on station in the Arabian Sea for 6 months, where it has been launching airstrikes against Afghanistan and Iraqi targets. Ordinarily, such deployments last 6 months, and then the carrier group returns to base for supply, resupply, and R&R for the crew. If the Enterprise is held over for a longer deployment after the arrival of the Eisenhower, we will know that something serious is planned. And then he adds, what is deeply troubling here is the total silence on the part of the Democratic Party opposition. Not one Democrat in Congress, he said, as far as I know, has demanded an answer from Bush and the Pentagon for the obvious military buildup around Iran. And in fact, I've even heard some voices on the left say, we need to get behind this thing. Iran's a bad, this guy, Ahmadinejad, he's a bad guy. We need to start, you know, getting in bed with the Republicans on this. And I actually heard a rant to that effect recently. From, shall we say, somebody on the left, and you know, with my mouth open, just jaw dropped. You're kidding. Bush is trying to whip up another war. And you know, is this going to be the outcome? I mean, it's incredible. It's not even springtime. No. It's autumn.
Deutschland is happy and gay.
Yeah.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out,
be afraid.
Here comes the master race. Strange times for Hitler and Germany.
Tragedy. May God bless you.
Winter for Poland and France.
Be afraid. We have fought the terror.
Spring time for Hitler.
We will stand on the offensive.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to me so straightforward that what we're seeing is the exact same thing that we saw before. There's not another way to say it, frankly.
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Well, I know that, George, but, you know, before you told us that you were the decider and that we weren't going to go into Iraq.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
And
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, yeah. And then it got really crazy. Then you said, okay, you got to pull the inspectors out because we're going to start bombing Iraq, right? I mean, Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei are over there. They're in Iraq. They're looking around. They're going, hey, just give us another couple weeks, and we'll have this whole thing figured out. And Bush says, nope, you got to come out because we're going to attack right now. And then later, he tries to rewrite history.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that.
Oops, sorry. Wrong button. Here we go.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power, along with other nations, so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's the kind of thing where you're just speechless. I mean, it's just you're kidding. You're kidding. So anyhow, Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker. Lest we forget, back in April was predicting this. The Bush administration, while publicly advocating diplomacy in order to stop Iran from pursuing a nuclear weapon, has increased in clandestine activities inside Iran and intensified planning for a possible major air attack. That was the first sentence of Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker. I mean, it's not like this should come as a secret to anybody. Here's Seymour Hersh again talking to Wolf Blitzer.
One of the real problems, the underlying problem, is simply this, that our government, our allies in Europe, even the Israelis, have not been able to come up with any specific evidence that the Iranians are doing what everybody thinks they're doing, running a secret program to make weapons. There's no parallel program. There's no sites. There's no evidence that they're doing anything other than what they say they're doing.
So,
once again, you know, is there the problem the military has and the reason why there's a fight is the Air Force, of course, has been tasked by the president, by the National Command Authorities, to come up with a decisive plan for bombing. And they have a huge plan. We're going to hit, you know, 1,000 aiming points or whatever. There's a lot of specific plans, but it's a pretty intensive bombardment. And the other services are saying, whoa, what do we have here? We don't know what to bomb. There's no evidence that these guys are doing anything. The only sites we know that are nuclear are the sites that have already been declared by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the monitoring agency in Vienna. So the only thing we know is what's publicly known.
And this is what boggles my mind, is that here you had Ahmadinejad before the United Nations a few weeks ago. Has it been that long? Yeah, two weeks ago or so, saying our nuclear program is peaceful. We will submit to inspections by the United Nations. We are on an ongoing basis being inspected by the United Nations. And where was the American press? I mean, that dimension of it simply was not reported in the American press. It wasn't. And yet at the same time, we've got Sam Gardner, the retired colonel, talking to Wolf Blitzer.
How close, in your opinion, is the U.S., the Bush administration, to giving that go-ahead order?
It's been given. In fact, we've probably been executing military operations inside Iran for at least 18 months.
Yeah, you get this. I mean, that's just the beginning of it. So do we have an invasion coming of Iraq, of Iran? Is the invasion of Iran or the bombing of Iran or the taking out of the, is this going to be the October surprise? And if so, what kind of consequences is that going to have for the United States? What kind of consequences is that going to have for peace in the world? And why are Democrats and progressives not speaking out about this right now to preempt it? You'll recall Richard Nixon was actually going to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. He actually intended to do it. And hundreds of thousands of people came out on the mall to march against it. And he decided not to because they marched. 16 minutes past the hour.
Our machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls on election day because we bought the election and it better go our way. And on election night, we'll sit back and gloat. The billionaires don't want you to vote.
Don't vote.
If you're happy with George Bush in charge, if you want to keep us living large, do you really want to rock the boat? Hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote. When other countries go and have an election day, people walk across mountains to have their say. Wait in line for days until the vote begins. They sit and watch the votes are counted to see who wins. Here in America, we put obstacles in your way. We're really hoping you stay home on election day. If you all voted, if each one of you just up and went, there'd be a very different government.
If you really want, yeah, we're looking at April to August of 1898 all over again. Could it be? I mean, just consider this. Here we've got this battleship flotilla. This headed for Iran. Now let me just provide some context here. On July 13th of last year, Soledad O'Brien and Miles O'Brien, oddly enough, were conducting an interview with a certain Mr. Slater. And I'm trying to find this. Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. And the question was asked, Soledad O'Brien, Karl Rove seems to be all about strategy, and you've said that he really modeled himself and his relationship on McKinley and his relationship with his campaign manager. Is that right? Now, President McKinley was the president in 1898. Put that in your brain for a minute. Wayne Slater says, this is the political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He says, that's right. Rove is loath to talk about this these days, but some years ago he talked at some length with me and others about the McKinley model. And essentially Rove, being sort of an amateur student of history, saw in the McKinley administration and the McKinley rise of the Republican Party and the domination of the Republican Party for 30 years. McKinley was the beginning of this. He saw that McKinley was important, and McKinley had a key figure named Mark Hanna who was behind the McKinley rise to power and the 30-year domination of the Republican Party. So in a sense, Rove sees himself as a Mark Hanna character one century later, and Bush, George Bush, as the McKinley character. Now, what did Hanna encourage McKinley to do? Well, there was this country that was basically thumbing its nose at the United States. They were having a revolution. The second bid for independence by Cuban revolutionaries began in April of 1895. President Grover Cleveland was president at the time. Next year, McKinley came in. And we tried to put down the insurrection. The Spanish government reacted by sending General Valerino Ewaler y Nicola with orders to pacify the island. This is from history.navy.mil. This is the official history site from the Navy, the U.S. Navy's military history site. With orders to pacify the island, the Butcher, as he became known in the U.S., determined to deprive the rebels of support by forcibly reconcentrating the civilian population near his military headquarters. This resulted in the starvation and death of over 100,000 Cubans. Now, Americans looked at this and they got really upset. On the one hand, they were upset about the Cuban uprising against the Spanish. You know, hey, it's destabilizing the area. On the other hand, they were upset with the Spanish for killing 100,000 Cubans right off our coast. There was this push on Cleveland and then on McKinley when McKinley became president to end the fighting in Cuba. American diplomacy, notes the Navy's military website, military history website, along with the return of the Liberal Party to power in Spain, led to the recall of General Weyler. However, beset by political enemies at home, the new Spanish government was too weak to enact meaningful reforms in Cuba. So now it's 1987. The U.S. government's mistrustful, but they're seeing that Spain has been weakened. And Carl Hanna sees an opportunity. This is not from the military website. This is, I mean, you find it a million other places. They don't talk about Carl Hanna on the Navy website. This is just the history of the USS Maine. But in any case, on 24 January 1898, President McKinley sent the second-class battleship USS Maine from Key West to Havana. The battleship arrived on 25 January. The Spanish authorities in Havana, this is from the military website of the U.S. Navy, Spanish authorities in Havana were wary of American intentions, but they afforded Captain Charles Sigsbee and the officers of the Maine every courtesy in order to avoid the possibility of trouble. The commander of the Maine did not even allow his enlisted men to go on shore. So everybody's walking eggshells here. And then on the 15th of February at 9:40 in the evening, an explosion shatters the stillness of Havana Harbor. It's the USS Maine. Later investigations revealed that more than 5 tons of powder charges for the vessel's 6- and 10-inch guns ignited, virtually obliterating the forward third of the ship. 263 men lost their lives. In the blowing up of that ship, McKinley established republicanism, Republicans.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. The truth you're told is just a pack of lies. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
So let's reconsider. Welcome back, by the way. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's reconsider. Let's just recap what's going on. We look back at 2002, the last midterm election. 2002, Jim Jeffords has left the Republican Party, and the Senate, for a period of a few months, is in the hands of the Democrats. Pat Leahy is the head of the Judiciary Committee. Tom Daschle is chairman of the Democrats. He's the Senate leader. He's the guy who makes the decisions about what comes to the floor for a vote and what doesn't. They're bringing forward the Patriot Act. They're bringing forward this consolidation, this creation of the Department of Homeland Security, all these right-wing pieces of legislation. And the Democrats are starting to stand up and say, we're not going to take all this stuff. We're not sure about it. And boom, the two guys who could have stopped the Patriot Act, Pat Leahy, who would have had to pass it out of the Judiciary Committee, and Tom Daschle, who would have had to bring it to the floor of the Senate, two guys get anthrax in the mail. America is terrified. Bush is beating the drums for war. The elections happen, and by hook or by crook, the Republicans gain control back of the Senate. And these guys are playing for keeps. They're playing for a generation. As Wayne Slater said to Soledad O'Brien on CNN, and I quote, "Rove is loath to talk about it these days, but some years ago, Rove talked at some length, I've talked to him and others, about the McKinley model. And essentially, Rove, being sort of an amateur student of history, saw in the McKinley race the rise of the Republican Party and the domination of the Republican Party of the United States for about 30 years. McKinley was the beginning of that a century ago. He said that he saw that McKinley was important and that McKinley had a key figure named Mark Hanna who was behind the McKinley rise and the success of the Republican Party. In a sense, Rove sees himself as a Mark Hanna character one century later and George Bush as the beginning of what he hopes is a fundamentalist realignment where Republicans will dominate Republican and Democratic politics in America, not just for years, but he hopes for decades." Okay, so you got that. And then we go back to 2002. And sure enough, George W. Bush using the lies. There's no other word for it. Lies, weapons of mass destruction, to invade Iraq, as I played this earlier, but it bears repeating, as Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission on the whole, 9/11 Iraq, why do we go into Iraq, et cetera. And she's talking about Mickey Herskowitz, the biographer, the guy who wrote the autobiography on behalf, who ghost wrote George W. Bush's, the first draft of George W. Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep. Mickey Herskowitz telling a reporter that Bush planned to go into Iraq in 1999.
"As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, 'One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
And I would suggest that in that, he was, for all practical purposes, simply echoing Karl Rove. We're going to create a generation of Republican rule. Well, what he didn't realize is that he's on the tail end of a generation of Republican rule. Ronald Reagan already did that. You say, well, what about Bill Clinton? Well, the Republicans ran the House, they ran Congress for all practical purposes for six of those 8 years. So here we are at the tail end of 26 years of Republican rule. So back to the USS Maine. The USS Maine sails into Havana Harbor. It blows up. The American people are already upset with the Spanish. The newspaper moguls all across the United States, led in large part by William Randolph Hearst, see, as news media often does, war will sell papers. Just like today, all the TV networks, it's a nation at war. Great new logo. War draws eyeballs. War increases ratings. War increases profits for the news media. So William Randolph Hearst reaches out to Mark Hanna and says, you get McKinley to declare war with Spain, I'll help him. You give me the war, I'll bring you the American people. And so McKinley says, well, the USS Maine blew up in Havana Harbor. It must have been the Spaniards who did it. Let's go to war with them. I mean, it wasn't quite that simple. It was actually a little bit more complex. Here's from the Navy's website. Fed by inflammatory articles in the yellow press blaming Spain for the disaster. This is the USS Maine. The death of several 266 soldiers. Fed by inflammatory articles in the yellow press, as William Randolph Hearst blaming Spain for the disaster, the public had already placed guilt on the Spanish government. Although he continued to press for a diplomatic settlement to the Cuban problem, President McKinley accelerated military preparations begun in January 1898 when an impasse appeared likely. The Spanish position on Cuban independence hardened. McKinley asked Congress on 11 April for permission to intervene. On 21 April, the president ordered the Navy to begin a blockade of Cuba, and Spain followed with a declaration of war on 23 April. You blockade their ports, they declare war on you. Congress responded with a formal declaration of war on 25 April, made retroactive to the start of the blockade. Thus began the Spanish-American War, where we fought the Spanish in Cuba and in the Philippines. We ended up in a guerrilla war in the Philippines that lasted 40 years. In fact, you could argue it's still going on today. There are still islands in the Philippines where the rebels are still fighting against, in some cases, American soldiers. And this was 1898. This was 110 years ago, 108 years ago. And now George W. Bush is sailing the USS Eisenhower through the Straits of Hormuz into the Persian Gulf. At the same time, he's making all this noise about these guys are evil. All the right-wing talk show hosts are whipping this thing up. I didn't see the show. I just saw the promo. Glenn Beck on CNN. You don't know why you should be afraid of Iran, but you should be. I'll tell you. Watch me tonight. Or words to that effect. And Ahmadinejad comes over to the UN and he says, hey, you want to see what's going on? Come on over. We'll show you. Send your tourists. Send your reporters. Send your journalists. Send anybody you want. You can visit our facilities. Yes, we're enriching uranium. We're enriching it up to 3.2% strength so that we can put it into a nuclear power plant. Well, why would they need a nuclear power plant? They're sitting on all this oil. Well, because the oil is going to run out in 20 or 30 years. Or maybe they want to make a bomb. I mean, maybe it's true. The CIA thinks it's probable. And it'll take 10 years. But Bush sees, in my opinion, and we'll see. I hope I'm wrong. I really and truly hope I'm wrong. I hope these guys are not this cynical. I hope they're not this psychotic. But when you look back at 2002 and you read the Downing Street memo from June of 2002, where George Bush met with Tony Blair, and then Tony Blair met with Jack Straw and the other leaders of his equivalent of the State Department in the United Kingdom, and he said Bush has already decided he's going to attack Iraq. It's a done deal, and we're going along with him on it. And at a month after the Downing Street memo was written, we didn't know about it, but a month after Tony Blair told his cabinet that the United States was going to go to war in Iraq, Bush is still running around going, are you kidding?
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
This is a bald-faced lie, or at least the first half of it, apparently. Now, according to the United States Constitution, he's not the guy who gets to decide either, so the entire thing was a lie. But we need to be sensitizing the American people to the fact that the October surprise may well be that we get a whole bunch of battleships in the Persian Gulf, and whether somebody like, Al-Qaeda, somebody like Osama bin Laden, does a USS Cole on us. I mean, all we have to do is just make it available. You know, they get some little boat, go up to it, blow it up. One of the ships sinks, a couple of Navy guys die, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100, who knows? And, hey, it must have been Iran that did that. Just like McKinley said, it must have been the Spanish. Turned out, by the way, it wasn't the Spanish who blew up the USS Maine. Had nothing to do with it. There was several inquiries. In 1976, Admiral Hyman G. Rickover published a book called How the Battleship Maine Was Destroyed. He concluded it was the coal that they were using to feed the boiler that blew up, and it was on the backside of a wall where they were storing the black powder for the cannons. When the coal caught on fire and blew the hole in the wall, a small explosion, it set off, 8-10 giant barrels of black powder, gunpowder, for all practical purposes, that blew the front third of the ship off. It had nothing to do with Spain, but it was a hell of a good excuse for a war. Are we going to see that again in the next 4 weeks? Or maybe in the next 6 months? I mean, keep in mind, Bush didn't invade Iraq until after the elections. All he needed was the war talk. 45 minutes after the hour.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears, Leonard Cohen. Spoken like a good Canadian. Welcome back. Yes, he is. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Blue in Missouri in our chat room points out, Tom, if you search, you will find we are still paying for the Spanish-American War on our phone bills. You're right. There is a surcharge, a communication surcharge, that was put on our phone bills to help pay for the Spanish-American War. And we're still paying it. By the way, as Blue also points out, today is the day that Spiro Agnew resigned. Yeah, marvelous anniversary. Would it were the day that Dick Cheney would resign, but he doesn't have the good graces of Mr. Agnew. Oh, my. 1-866-440-8466. Is North Korea, for the moment, has changed the conversation away from Iran. Mark Foley has changed the conversation away from Iran. The Democrats think that they're doing just fine. Bush is down in the polls. The Republicans are down in the polls. We are 4 weeks, more or less, away from an election. Actually, I think we're 4 weeks to the day from an election. And I guarantee you, the Republicans are going to figure out a way to have the conversation be all about war, all about terror, all about be afraid. Be afraid, be afraid, be afraid. That's their mantra. I mean, Bush at the in his speech before the Republican National Committee.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness. The continuing
and this is just this is
terrorism.
This is just an in series, in order montage of Bush speaking to his own people.
And nothing will hold us back, and we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat.
And they are...
was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan...
Yeah, Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged by the Bush administration. They are going to figure out a way and to bring this conversation back. And if it means having a provocation in the Gulf region, I wouldn't put it past them. And I realize this sounds incredibly cynical, but they have done it before.
Doing battle in Afghanistan and Iraq. The resurrection, Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, radical ideology of hate, kill the innocent, tyranny and terror.
Yeah, George W. Bush's speech before the Republican National Convention, the RNC, the big convention, in which he was renominated in 2004. Terror, terror, terror. Be afraid, be afraid. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Well, yes, it shouldn't be any big surprise that the Democrats aren't going to say very much about Iran. I mean, quite frankly, with the pro-Israel lobby and all that, you had Howard Dean calling the president of Iraq an anti-Semite.
But he is. I mean, Ahmadinejad is an anti-Semite, and I don't think this has anything to do with the Israel lobby. This has to do with George W. Bush wanting, and the neocons, frankly, wanting to have a footprint in the Middle East, a strong, large footprint, and thinking that the best way to do it is militarily, not politically.
Well, first of all, many Arabs are Semites. The thing is, this war, the reason people don't want to speak out against it is because you got that idiot over there in Iran always talking about, oh, the Holocaust never happened, and it was exaggerated and everything.
Yeah.
So I just think people...
Well, but the Persians don't consider themselves Semites, so I think you could broadly say that Ahmadinejad really is probably one of the actual true anti-Semites. But Joe, good, you know, interesting point. But, I just don't see this as something that's being driven by any kind of... frankly, by Israel or any other kind of conspiracy of international proportions beyond simply the Republicans wanting to have single-party rule in the United States for a generation. It's just that simple. And they know that if they lose, even for 2 years, if they lose the House or the Senate, the investigations will bring this entire house of cards down. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten.
Tom, this will take about 1 minute, and God bless you for your work.
Thank you.
On October 5th, according to current FISA parameters, I risked my personal liberties. On an open mic, I publicly accused this administration of a corporate global coup against the United States of America. America, you have legs. A great many of our latest warriors lost theirs, so you could use yours to stand up and walk and phone and email for this country. There is no excuse for your complacency. And what will you use for an excuse for your complacency? They risk their lives daily.
Kirsten, so respectfully, I believe that most of the people you're speaking to are not complacent.
Well,
you know, if you want to talk to the complacent ones, call the Limbaugh show,
well,
although he won't put you on the air.
Your audience, I know, but you do have some listeners who are in our...
The fact of the matter is, the tragic fact of the matter is, Kirsten, is that because of the success of Reagan's war against the middle class, we have people working 2, 3, 4 jobs,
right,
barely making it by. They don't have time to read the newspaper. They don't have, they're economically disempowered, which means they're politically disempowered.
Right.
And frankly, I think we have to deal with that as at the same time. But yeah, I understand and share your righteous indignation. And we need to get people out on the streets. And I gotta run. We gotta wrap the show up. But thank you for the call, Kirsten. It was kind of you. Conservative Ben Shapiro here tomorrow. He's going to tell us the liberals are lying about the NIE report, the National Intelligence Estimate. That should be an interesting one. And in our Everything You Know Is Wrong, does President Bush secretly want to turn the U.S., in Mexico, and Canada into one giant country? That and more right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program tomorrow, Truth in Broadcasting. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.